This Week in Retronauts, putting the Vania back in Metroidvania. Everyone, it's me, Jeremy Parrish, and here I am recording another Retronauts episode, and this is another special episode with a game developer. This time it's not someone who created a game a long time ago, but someone who created a game just recently. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is James Petruzzi, and I'm the director and designer of Chasm that just released on PS4 and Steam.
And like I said, putting the Vania back in Metroidvania, this is... Of all the Metroidvania style games I've played, I feel like this is the one that really best captures the feel of Symphony of the Night, which is surprisingly not that common. Like, you know, there's a lot of Metroidvania type games these days, but they tend to go more for the Metroid or, you know, some sort of oblique
just
Metroidvania-ish thing in its own direction. Like, you know, you look at stuff like Yoku's Island Express or Hollow Knight or Dead Cells, and they're kind of doing their own thing. So you've got kind of the structural element there, but not so much the actual feel. Whereas Chasm, like, I play this and I think this is a man who really likes Symphony of the Night, and I approve of that because the feel of it is really good. And there has been no video game character who has controlled quite like Alucard in that game, but our nameless protagonist in Chasm comes really close, like impressively close.
Cool, thank you. Yeah, I studied it obsessively. You know, a lot of it comes down to timings and things like that. And you know, when you start talking about game feel, you get into reaction times and how many MS this is and that, and how things should react, and like in time spans that you can't even really notice. You know, so. I had to get creative just to try to capture that feel. So I ended up capturing a lot of recorded footage and studying it frame by frame and like kind of seeing like all the little tricks that they were doing that you don't really get when you're playing it at 60 frames a second. So, but yeah, as you said, like my whole thing with this game was trying to bring back the feel of Castlevania games and something that felt just like them. And I wanted to make sure it wasn't some game that, you know, like those kind of, I don't want to call them knockoff games, but like, you know, it's kind of like, oh, this looks like an NES game, but they didn't really get it. Like they use all these different colors that don't really confine to the NES palette.
And right.
Like, it doesn't, it's like, it kind of looks like it, but it doesn't really capture it, the true essence of it. So, you know, I definitely spent a lot of time trying to find that balance for the gameplay mechanics and all that.
Yeah, I don't think you have to be slavish in sticking to NES or Super NES or Genesis limitations, but it helps.
Yeah,
I mean, that's one of those things that it's kind of subtle, and I don't think a lot of people really know it or notice it when they're playing. But when you play a game, something like, not to point any fingers at anyone, but like Cladun, I don't know if you've played that classic dungeon, which is published by NIS. Like it goes for that kind of 8-bit... style, but at the same time it's not convincing because it has different resolutions for things. Like your heroes are chunky pixels, and then there's backgrounds that are like super detailed.
Even
Double Dragon 4 was guilty of that. Like
the graphics
in that just aren't consistent.
It's funny because like you see the sprite characters and be like, oh, it's like classic Double Dragon, and then you see the backgrounds and
you're like,
kind of breaks that illusion a little bit.
Right.
And that's how I felt with the mechanics, like coming at Chasm. And you know, and we were very careful with the art side too, you know, since we're talking about the art, like, in particular, like there's a lot of things that make an NES game feel like an NES game or a Genesis game feel like a Genesis game. Like when you look at them, and a lot of that comes down to, like we're saying, the color palettes and the restrictions. And it's like, if you don't really understand fully, like all the restrictions that they're working with, you end up with something that kind of looks like it, but not, you know. And, we made a lot of deliberate decisions early on. Probably the first one that kind of like locked us into this mode was we're going low resolution. So everything in the game world that gets rendered is actually rendering to a 384 by 216 buffer, which is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And then that keeps all of your pixel sizes the same. So
what's that the native resolution of? What the hell has a 384 by 216 resolution?
Nothing. I think I saw a couple Capcom games actually ran
on that. Like
on
CPS.
CRT.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a couple out there. It's not very common. Their vertical height was a little bit taller, though. It was more like 240 instead of 216.
Right. Yeah,
The reason I chose that resolution, though, is because it perfectly 5x scales up to 1080p, or you can 10x scale up to 4K. Because 4K is like 3840 by 2160. Mm-hmm. So it's basically that just divided by 10.
So you're future-proofing. You're looking.
Well, I didn't even realize that at the time, funny enough. But, you know, it worked out. So that was like one of the very first decisions we made as far as the art direction was do a real low resolution, keep all the pixel sizes consistent. Now, since we're working with modern hardware, we could use whatever colors we want. And that came down to the artist to stay consistent. So like our animator, he'd kind of come up with like a general palette for the enemies for each character or general palette for the enemies for each area. There we go. And kind of stick with that. Like, so a lot of the enemies will be different colors, but they kind of reuse some of the same shades. And then obviously the background art for each area, they also stayed consistent with, since they're all in one sheet, it was easy for them to kind of reuse the same colors. So, you know, there you go with your like correct pixel sizes. We're not mixing at all. And then like we've got the colors. So I think like visually, we were able to hit that kind of Super Nintendo-ish Genesis feel. I don't think it really feels like either of them in particular. It kind of feels like a weird in-between almost. Because our color palette is wider than those systems could do, but we purposely limited ourselves within that, you know. So they could choose any color in the RGB spectrum,
right? But it's you're how only many showing of those, like 64 at a time on the screen.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
Yeah.
And we didn't get that crazy with it. It's not like we were counting colors. It's just like when you design characters, you want to keep the color counts down, and when you're working in the environment art, you want to keep the color counts down. And then when you kind of combine it all together, it gives you that feel. So I would say we were successful on that side, you know. And I think that's one of the things that help the game get legs a lot, especially at like game shows and stuff, because we'd be showing it and people would see the art from across the room and it would just like stick out to them. You know, they'd be like, whoa, that reminds me of this, this, and this. You know, like as soon as they saw it, they were kind of sold on the concept of the game, which is kind of crazy to me, you know, because it's like as a game designer and all that, like you never want to fall back on like selling something so simply, like, oh, it looks good, like that's good enough. Like, but, you know, obviously we put a lot of work into everything else to feel like a retro game, which we can talk about. But it's definitely the art that initially grabs people. And then you have to sell them with the gameplay and everything else, you know, like once they pick up the controller.
Like I said, clearly you looked to Symphony of the Night for inspiration on the controls and the overall vibe. But why specifically that game? I mean, like I said, most Metroidvanias kind of go for either the Metroid thing, like Axiom Verge really nails it.
Yeah.
Or you have something like Guacamelee, where it's just like, I've never played a game quite like this.
But yeah, it's weird.
You know, it still kind of follows Metroid's rules.
Yeah. So I guess for me, personally, it's more of a passion project because I'm a huge fan of not just Symphony of the Night, but really all the Castlevania games, going all the way back to the original NES one.
Yeah, you know? I saw your video game shrine in your game room.
Yep.
Castlevania and Simon's Quest.
I've got your Castlevania book, by the way, and I'm going to have to sign it before you leave here.
Okay.
So I'm getting an autograph on that thing. But yeah, so I've studied like all of that stuff. Huge Castlevania fan all the way since I was a kid. You know, the funny thing real quick is like I never played Castlevania 1 as a kid. I remember for some reason, I don't remember if it was like my birthday or something, my mom took me to Hills, which is probably gone now, and I got to pick out one game, and it was Castlevania 2. Now, all these years
that's a rough start, really.
Yeah, all these years later now, I'm like, man, I should have picked 1, like, you know, knowing what I know now. But I picked 2, and I loved it. Like, I didn't get it, like, at all. Like, I never beat the game. I probably never made it further than I would make if I sat down and played it for an hour now. But I don't know, man. This is the thing with like retro games. It's just like Zelda 1 for me. That was like my favorite game as a kid, where the world is not kind to you. Like, it's like ambivalent. Mm-hmm. It's like Zelda world exists whether you know where to go or not, or know what to do. And I feel like Castlevania 2 is the same. And well, I mean, that game
actually
definitely...
Castlevania 2 isn't ambivalent towards you. It actually dislikes you.
Yeah.
It actively wants to.
Well, and that's a lot in the translation too, which
no, it's not. Like, I thought so too, but I remember interviewing Igarashi one time. Oh man, it's probably been like 12 or 13 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kind of revisited Castlevania 3 for Dawn of Sorrow.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, so, you know, you've kind of revisited these older games. Have you ever thought about going back to do something in the style of Castlevania 2? And he was like, I didn't really like that game. Everyone lied to you. And so that was when I realized, oh, so it wasn't,
so
just,
it wasn't just the translation.
It was actually accurate. And those people really tried to mislead you. So
gotcha.
That's a rough start. I mean, that was
yeah.
You know, a game deliberately screwing you over and telling you things that were useless or yep. counterproductive.
I just think there's something to the feel of those kind of games. I mean, whether it's that deliberate or not, where it's like, I don't know, you just have to like kind of figure things out for yourself. And it's like a conundrum in a conundrum, you know, and it's kind of weird, too, when you think about it, because both that and Zelda are so pure action games. You know, it's like the basic mechanics are just move around and hit things, like, and both are melee for the most part. You know, in Zelda, you get long range once you're powered up, but they're both very like kind of hardcore combat and stuff. But at the same time, it's just like, figure out where to go. Like, hopefully you find something, go buy Nintendo Power. That was probably part of it. Maybe, I don't know. You know? So I remember though, as a kid, like Zelda was my jam. Like that was the game that made me fall in love with games. Like I liked Kung Fu and I liked Mario. I love those games. Even Contra. I loved Contra. But Zelda was the game where I took the manual with me to elementary school every day, like just kept reading it, trying to pore over it. I'd come home, I got the Nintendo Power issue, you know, where they had the big map in there, like just trying to figure out everything I could about that game. Because it's so different. I don't know. I guess people today probably wouldn't like understand it, because today, like when you play a game, maybe Dark Souls, you know, those kind of games are probably the closest you could get, I think, to that feeling where it feels like there's this like entire world out there and it's not explained to you at all. Like, it's just like it's up to you to like try to get it or not. And you really don't even need to, I guess, in a certain level. But yeah, there's just something to it where it felt like I had to learn everything I possibly could about it to even have a chance, you know, to play the game. And it was something bigger than just that combat feedback loop that, you know, I was just mentioning. So there's more to it where and I think like when you're a kid too, it's perfect because your imagination is like boundless, you know, and you're just like anything could be around the next corner. You never know, you know. So yeah, those are the kind of things that like stuck with me about those experiences that I tried to bring back to Chasm. I don't know how successful I was, but you know, I tried to like get that feel of the world and the atmosphere and, you know, the tight gameplay controls and kind of mash it all together again and see if I could make something like that.
Yeah, like for me, Zelda was definitely the original Zelda was definitely a game that got its hooks into me, and I spent a few weeks one summer really just like working it inside out and out, and then beat it, and then was like, I'm gonna do the second quest and beat that in just a few days, actually, because once I got it. But before that, there was Metroid, and that was the one that really kind of, you know, made me say like, what's out there? You know,
I spent
hours and hours trying to get into the secret worlds that I read about in Nintendo Power, not realizing it was just a bug.
Yeah.
And that I was, you know, wasting my time trying to find something that wasn't actually there. Like the developers never put there, but it didn't matter because it was so entrancing. You know, I know there's better endings I can get. I know I can get my time down. I know I can do the New Game Plus thing. So yeah, that was really engrossing. But the Castlevania games always had a special place for me too. Like the original Castlevania. I know I've told this story on the podcast, but like my family traveled across the country one summer on vacation, and that was like the year that I had to get Castlevania, but it was out of print. So, you know, when I finally got my hands on it, it was like, I finally got it.
Yeah, it was like, so I guess a lot of people don't remember.
Yeah.
Well, I guess a lot of people today don't even know, but like back then there was like shortages of memory chips and like you couldn't get games. Like today, like we're completely spoiled. If you want a game, you just go right on PSN or Steam or whatever and download it. There's no, we have a wave of cartridges coming maybe in a few months for this one game.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the closest thing now is when a game gets delisted.
Yeah.
Then it's gone forever.
Yeah, like, it's gone forever.
You're not going to buy Scott Pilgrim versus the World ever again.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, Castlevania, there was a chance you'd be able to rent it, or maybe someone would have a copy that they'd lend you, or it would come back into print.
I remember Super Mario 2 was the other big one, like, you couldn't even get a hold of.
Yeah. That one I saw when it very first came out and thought, I don't know, I got kind of bored of the original Super Mario Brothers after playing it so much. I don't know if I want this. And then the next day I decided, yeah, I do. And it was gone. And it took, like, 4 months for me to find it again. Yep. So
that's another game that, like, I really liked, especially in Super Mario 2. It kind of reminded me of that same vibe we were talking about from Zelda and Castlevania, where it's like, the first one, it didn't feel like you're really exploring at all. You know, it's like you'd go down the tube and then you're just in a little chamber, you get some coins, and then you're back to the main world. Like, two to me felt like a little different. It had all these doors that would, like, go places, and then there's, like, this, like, inside or the dark world, whatever you want to call it. I can't remember what the official name is.
Subspace, but, I think.
Yeah, subspace. So there was, like, all these interesting things where it would, like, make you think, like, is there more to this? Is there other things here? You know, like, they did a great job with that game. I mean, obviously, we know now that it wasn't a real Super Mario game all these years later.
It was
secretly.
It was made by the people who made Mario with Mario-style mechanics and then turned into a Mario game. So,
yeah.
To me, that's real.
It's real enough. But yeah, it's just a very interesting experience. I mean, like, I love all those early games because they're just so experimental, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, let's just throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, you know?
Right. It's hard to find that sense of, I don't know what's out there in games anymore because, you know, everything's been worked out. The rules have been laid down. And, you know, in most cases, games are like a little hand appears on screen and says, go this way. Or there's a flashing arrow or, you know, someone draws something on the map for you.
That was another thing that, like, with Chasm, I was like, I wanted it to feel like... there's obvious clues in Metroidvanias. You know, it's like when you see a ledge that's like twice as tall as your character, you're like, oh, I come back here with the flip, right. Like or the double jump. You know, like there's no thinking to it. It's just like you see an obstacle. Same thing with the in Chasm, we have like the slide power up that gets you kind of into the crawl spaces. And
yeah, your game definitely uses a lot of the kind of standard vocabulary for sure.
Yeah, so. And then like when you get a little bit further into it though, like I started kind of. And I don't know how far you've gotten through it, but, like, once you get to a certain point, I stopped using that so much. Like, there's a lantern power-up, you know, that,
just
like,
found that.
Kind of gets you into dark spaces. And I don't want to spoil the ending, but I took some inspiration from Symphony of the Night, actually, for one of the key items where it's not a power-up, like, that gets you to that next spot, you know. And you kind of have to put it together. Like, there's, like, a whole puzzle with it. But I tried to at least make it obvious, like, the points. Or at least I thought. I don't know. Some people are like, well, I was running around forever and I couldn't find where to go. But I at least tried to make it sort of obvious, like, make the rooms interesting looking or, you know, like... we actually added the ability to the map. So if you're in a room, you can, like, press X to, like, mark the spot on your map. So even if it's not, like, that super obvious double jump point and you go into a room and you're like, oh, this is, like, a weird gate. Like, you can mark it on your map. Come back to later and hopefully figure it out. But I don't know, that's like one of the frustrating points I think of that can be frustrating in Metroidvanias. I mean, like, I remember I never played Super Metroid as a kid. I know, crucify me. My friend rented it and one summer when we were probably like 13 or something, and oh my god, he should have just bought the game. He like rented it for weeks. He was like trying to beat it, and I know he spent over $50, or his mom did, like, renting this game over and over for him, and he could have just bought it. But I kind of just watched him play it most of the time. And, of course, he was one of those guys that, like, would never give you the controller ever.
Right.
Right? So you're just, like, basically hanging out with him, watching him play. But so I never played it as a kid. And maybe that's actually what kind of turned me off from playing it, was watching him play it and not being able to play. But so years later, I came back to it, and I remember getting so frustrated when I got to the point where you have to powerbomb the glass tube. Because there's like, okay, there's another glass tube in the game you can see that's broken. But, you know, it's kind of like one of those things where it's like you're exploring the world and then you get to your dead end. And then it's kind of like you're just like looping around the world trying to find what to do next. You know, like there's no marking in the map or anything like that. Like it was just kind of like, oh, you got to see this hint that this one room's like this and then see the other and realize it's different. But there was like no power up to really like really lead you there, like visually show you. I mean, I guess it did visually show you with the tube busted, but I don't think it like connected for me like a double jump would, you know, where it's like, oh, I can traverse that now.
Well, that's actually an Easter egg in that game. Like, you don't have to go that way. There's another route.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, there's another route into the
water. Okay, well, see, that shows you how much I know
about
it.
But that's like a shortcut, yeah.
Okay, so I ran around forever trying to figure out where to go, and, like, I don't even know. I think I eventually had to look it up.
I think the attract mode will show you that.
Does it?
If I'm not mistaken. Oh, but you have to, like, leave the system running and let it loop through the attract mode.
Everybody's, like, turning out his podcast, and I'm like, this guy has no clue what he's talking about. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm human. You know, I've only played as many
but
games
that's,
as
yeah,
I can.
But that's what's interesting about games like this is that, you know, even if it clicks for you, there's still sometimes they throw in things that, you know, they surprise you and they're not what you expect. And you have to kind of think laterally, like you get into sort of a comfortable groove and then all of a sudden you run up against a wall and you're like, I don't know what to do next. And so then that becomes kind of the challenge. And I guess that's where people either give up or
I was gonna say, like,
they become
this,
determined to say, like,
that's
I
where
am
it
going
comes
to be
down
this.
To the person. It's like you can design that stuff as well as you want, but a perfect example actually we could talk about that I know you've played was the puzzle in the catacombs that you need to use to get through the gate to the boss. So I know in the version you played, the clues were all in different rooms. And we had a lot of people complaining at launch, like, I don't think it was so much that the puzzle was complex, but it was the fact that, like, you didn't get the puzzle until you saw, like, until you got the journal entry and saw all the clues, and then you had to run back and forth to all those rooms again and then try to figure out the clues. So it created, like, a lot more frustration than I intended, like, when I designed it. So that actually got nerfed a little bit. So if you play in the latest build, all those... So for the people listening, the idea to the puzzle is that there's essentially a gate that has three numbers you have to put in, and then there's three rooms in the world that each have a clue to input that. And these people are just hitting a wall with it. Like, I didn't expect that, but they were, and getting frustrated with all the backtracking. So what we ended up doing was combining all three of those paintings into one long hallway. So all the clues are now kind of in one stretch.
Okay, yeah. That's... I did that this morning, and I noticed that there is kind of like, it's not so much a stretch, but it's basically like a just like a self-contained space in the map where all those rooms are. Because there were, I got two of them, and then realized I didn't remember the third one, so I had to go back.
Yep.
But it was pretty easy because I was like, well, I know it's going to be in here somewhere.
Yeah.
So I feel like kind of containing those into a small space. Makes sense. So that's something that Super Metroid did a lot, too.
Yeah.
There were a few points where I, you know, the first time I played, I hit a wall. And I was like, oh, I need to backtrack. And I realized, oh, I can't backtrack. The game actually kind of corrals you into certain places.
Right.
And it gives you sort of a boundary on where you can go. And you have to figure out the puzzle within that space, which can be frustrating if you can't figure it out. But, you know, if there's nothing else to do at that point in the game, the last thing you want to do is go search the entire damn map. Because I've done that in so many games where I'm, like, looking all over, like, going into every room in, say, Metal Gear and trying, you know, every comm frequency to get a clue. And then the answer was right by where the puzzle was in the first place.
And you just missed it.
Right.
And you go wandering
forever. Yeah, so having those kind of corralled into a certain space, I think that's a good design change.
Yeah, well, and I think, like, you know, my whole thing with that puzzle was when you pull the lever the first time and it drops you down into that pit, I just assumed that people would figure that, like, the answers were down there. But not everybody thought that. So it's like they'd run around that area real quick, maybe miss them, and then they'd be gone all over, you know, like, way outside. So it's just hard to anticipate what's going to land with people and what's not. And I think that's probably where the focus testing comes in. And I know there's probably a lot of eye rolls, you know, immediately, like when you start talking focus testing, as far as like, you're ruining your vision and all that. But, you know, at some point, it's like, you kind of want it to be playable and you don't want people to get frustrated and just give up, especially for something like that, that I think's like earlier into the experience. And you're kind of just going too far left field. You know, it's like you kind of want to introduce these like concepts a little bit slower. So, you know, I think that was a good tweak though that we made for that, where at least since all the clues are in one spot, if you don't get it, you can just go back to that one spot and figure it out and then go right back to the lock. You're not running all over the entire section. So honestly, that was probably one of the most out there puzzles in the game, I think. Like, as far as, well, there's another that's similar later in the castle area, but I think by that point, you kind of get how the game flows. It's like, okay, sometimes you might have to figure out how to proceed in just this small area. Sometimes you might need to leave the area entirely and go look where else you can use your last power up, mm-hmm. you know? So, I think it's tricky because it's like you want variation to the game, you know? So you got to just try different things and kind of see what works. But yeah, so.
Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who enjoys going back and finding the things I couldn't get before. So yeah. Every time I get one of the power-ups, I'm like, well, I can climb walls now a little bit, you know, like grip walls.
Yep.
So I remember a few spots where I just couldn't quite make the jump, but I know I can get those now. Or now I can slide, you know, under narrow spaces. Yep. So I remember where there were some spots on the map where I couldn't do that before. And every time I'm rewarded, you know, for going back, there's either a cool piece of armor or something that's going to be essential for navigating the world later. So I feel like it does a good job of sort of giving you incentive to go back and make use of these power-ups. And, you know, some of the things are kind of superfluous, but they're pleasant surprises. Like the first time I put on the bird hat, I was like, oh, yeah. I get a little bit of a constitution bonus over what I've got. That's nice. And then all of a sudden I've got a friend. Boom, and now yeah. My friend is like attacking, my hat is attacking bad guys. As with as much power as I have, I'm like, well, okay.
I know. Well, you know, it's funny too with the bird hat. Like, I don't know. Maybe this is just me trying to combat that whole like, oh, I'm gonna go look everything up on GameFAQs thing. You know, like, so I purposely didn't put a lot of the effects of the items directly in the descriptions because I wanted people to experiment and figure out like what things do. And it's funny because I saw some people saying like, I didn't even try putting that on because I saw the stats were lower. Like, I didn't even bother. And I played through the whole game without it.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you learn with RPGs is that sometimes you get something and it's at a point in the game where you're like, well, why would I use this? The stats are so low. Why? Yeah. It's a downgrade. That means it's got something special to it. There's some sort of special feature to it.
Yeah, and then I'd see on Steam people would be like, oh, I saw this item and I didn't even bother using it because the power was 3 lower than the hammer I already had. But, you know, maybe that hammer had something special about it if you kill things with, you know. I don't know, like, I just kind of felt like, and I know Castlevania even, Symphony of the Night, they put a lot of the effects of the items in the descriptions.
Yeah, but like, some of them didn't. Like, the jewel sword sucks.
Yeah.
But every time you attack with it, you get jewels. And exactly. If you do the special attack with it, you get a lot of jewels.
Yep.
And it's never explained. That's not explicitly indicated.
It's one
in
of
the
those
game.
Things that it's like you spend time with the game. Mm-hmm. To figure it out. It's not just handed to you. And I feel like that's fair for the stuff that is like out of the ordinary. You know what I mean? Like none of those things are required whatsoever, even in the slightest degree. It's all just like optional stuff. And if you want to fool around and kind of just experiment, you know, because it's like the world's a sandbox. You can try all these different items and weapons and, you know, killing different creatures, trying to find, you know, their drops and all that. But it's up to each player. Like, if you're just a power player and you just go for the highest stats, you don't care about any of that, like, you know, you're going to play it one way. And if you're somebody that likes all the weird stuff and doesn't care about that, you'll probably experiment and try everything. But I think part of it, too, though, was just, like, I didn't want the whole game known in, like, a week, mm-hmm. you know? And I mean, like, we put it up for the Kickstarter backers to play 2 weeks before launch, and they had already started. Somebody had already unlocked all the bestiary entries, taken screenshots of every single monster in the game. This is like a week before launch, you know? And it's like, oh man, like everything in the game is like already been figured out, it feels like. But it wasn't because I like locked out the, you know, you can't see the items that the enemies drop until you get the drops. So that slowed things down a little bit. But then these guys would figure out one of the enemies has an item that helps you get other items easier. So somebody found that, and then they unlocked all the others. So I would say probably within just a few days of launch, people had already figured out every single enemy drop in the game. But because I didn't make all the descriptions obvious, there are definitely items out there I've seen that people have not figured out, like, what they're really for yet, which is awesome. You know?
So the bird hat is not an exception to the rule. It's more like,
yeah,
there's a lot of stuff in the game that has weird effects like that.
I mean, I wouldn't say a ton, but, you know, I mean, we're talking a good amount of stuff that, like, you know, people have still yet to find. So, you know, I feel like at least then it wasn't, it was for at least a good reason that some of the stuff is a little less obvious, you know? So, I mean, some stuff will tell you straight up, like the mithril armor regenerates your health, but it tells you right in the description because it's like a really low defense. So I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, I made some of them obvious like that. It's just like, tells you right in the description, like, oh, the regenerates the wearer's health or whatever. And it's just, that's all. That's all there is to it. And but then there's other items that are much less obvious what they do. So I don't know. It's like I wanted different degrees to it. You know, like some things don't tell you at all, some hint, and some tell you like straight out like what they do. So at least I think it feels like, because I feel like if we went too far in either direction, like if everything was super obvious, people would have had everything figured out already and it would just be a whatever. Like there wouldn't be any of that fun of discovery. I think that's like a lot of what right. I was trying to preserve.
Yeah.
And it's so hard in the internet age to do that, because I mean, if this was 20 years ago when this game came out, it would be months before anybody put all this together, you know, into some sort of format that you could read, like a game fact or something, like, or a Nintendo strategy guide or anything like that. Like you were like isolated from all this knowledge, you know, and now, like I said, the full bestiary dropped out in screenshots with everything before launch, even. It's just like, that's the world that we live in now.
Yeah, I think World of Warcraft broke video gaming for everyone, because the wiki approach became sort of, you know, how you play World of Warcraft. And mm-hmm. as soon as a patch hits, everyone's like, what's in there? Let's break it down and suss it out.
Yeah, and I think like we were talking earlier at the very beginning of our conversation, it kind of kills that sense of discovery and wonderment a little bit when everything's kind of already broken down before you even go into the game. You know, it's like, here's every power up in the game. Here's every enemy. Here's every item. Here's every, this is how you do all the secret stuff.
Yeah. And you know, it's not hard to avoid spoiling yourself, but I realize there are some people who just can't help themselves.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
like, the information's out there. I need to know it.
Yep.
And you know, I have nephews, you know, they're like elementary age, and they will have watched comprehensive playthroughs of games on YouTube long before they get to play them. One of my nephews is, every time he comes over to my house, he plays a little more of Undertale on my Vita.
Yeah.
But he knows that game inside and out because he's watched so many YouTube playthroughs of it. So every time he's like, oh, it's this scene. So he's familiar with everything. It's just, he's kind of experiencing it for himself in first person. But there aren't any surprises for him, but he's okay with that.
Yeah, it's so weird.
I guess it's, you know, different expectations for people. I like being surprised. I haven't read anything about Chasm, and I'm, you know, playing it through for the first time blind.
Yeah.
So I am discovering things and saying, oh, okay, that's cool. I didn't expect that. Like, it wasn't in the description, and I'm glad I tried this out because
yeah.
now I've got a little friend who flies around with me.
Yeah, and I think, like, that kind of general idea kind of goes all the way to the core of the game. And this has been our biggest, I'm sure you'll want to talk about this, our biggest contention point is the procedural generation.
Yeah.
Of the idea of that, well, so let me step back. When the game was very first conceived, I was thinking like it would be a straight roguelike. As it kind of went, by the time we got to the Kickstarter, I kind of started seeing like, yeah, if this is our one chance to make like a big game, I don't want to make it like a small roguelike style game. But I thought we could still use the procedural generation to our advantage, which is getting right back to what we were just talking about, where you can't go to GameFAQs and say, tell me how to get everywhere in the game, because the paths are going to be different. The clues are different to solve the puzzles, like the combination to the catacombs gate that we were just talking about.
Yeah, I had a feeling that's randomized, because
yeah,
it looks
so,
like the murals where you find the clues.
Yeah, so the
like,
paintings are made where the clues are layered on them.
Okay.
So every time you start a new game, you know, it might be 3 cups on that table, or it might be 8 cups, you know. So details like that are switched around. So, for people listening that don't really understand the game as a whole, the way the procedural generation works is that there is a lot of key points in the world. And these key points are, say, like the entrance to the mines. That's a key point. And then where is your next like key point when you enter the mines? It's rescuing one of the main characters, Bastin, and he's guarded by this cave troll. So the procedural generation kind of comes into play in between those points. I basically hand designed like a layout of the world, and that I thought would be cool. And then we taught the procedural generator how to recreate variations of that. So we could say, when you walk into the mines until you fight the first mini boss and rescue Basden, we want 10 rooms between those two points. And those rooms can have trolls in them. They can have slimes, you know, low level slimes. They can have glow worms. And we got a few jumping puzzles. And that's it. And then every time you start a new game, it kind of uses that same formula to build that path out there. So it's not going to be wildly different. And I think this is like a point of contention with people is like how random you want your game. Like some people are fine with it that every time you walk into the mines for the first time, you're always going to go left to get there. Like it's always a leftward jaunt out there because there is a overall structure to the world. Like the gardens is always to the west. The catacombs are always to the east. Like that is kind of like in cement, like where a lot of the things are spatially located in the world. And we're kind of like working within restrictions in that and kind of building these paths in between. And so we get questions like, well, what's the point of it then? You know, like if it's not going to be crazy different every time and I'm not going to go right or I'm not going to go left, you know, and I'm not completely lost, then, you know, like what was the point? And I don't know. You know, for me, it's like I played Symphony of the Night a million times and it's like every time I bust some candle, I know what's there. You know, like that sense of discovery is gone. Like there's never going to be anything different in that game if I go back and play it 10 years from now or 20 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken to always using the luck code when I play Symphony of the Night because that yep. does make it unpredictable. You know, I did a live stream once where I used the live code and I was like, I don't know how far I'm going to make it because it can be really hard.
Yeah.
But then I went up against the first doppelganger, you know, in the clock tower and I killed it in one hit because I got a like super lucky strike
yeah,
and it was like strike. Ultra critical. So, you know, you never know. You don't know what's going to happen. You may have a hell of a time fighting a boss.
Yeah.
Like chipping away, doing no damage all, mm-hmm. You know, through the entire fight.
Or you get like a crazy item drop.
Incredibly lucky. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, kind of like in Chasm, there are enemies in certain places that drop things that make it easier to get other things. And so you start yep. kind of building up on that and you get this like super variable game. But it is within, you know, the boundaries that were predefined by the map. And it sounds like yours is basically, you know, though I've been kind of watching and trying to figure out like how does the procedural generation in this game work? And I've played, you know, messed around with a couple of different seeds and I've kind of got a feel for how everything works. But things do... They are placed differently. Like the yeah. one I'm playing through now, I had the hardest time finding Narina. So I made it into like the catacombs, I want to say, before finding her. And I eventually backtracked and figured out where she was.
Oh, man.
But yeah, like I had to beat bosses just with, you know.
Just a sword.
Like, crappy sword, no special weapons, man. Basic armor. And I was like, this is really hard. But then kind of once I, you know, got through that, then... I got really good at the game.
Yeah. Kind of get the feel for it.
So yeah, like it was not predictable. It was a little bit frustrating, but not in a bad way where I'm like, this game's broken. It was more like, I'm broken. I can't figure this thing out. What's going on?
Well, you know, funny, speaking of the spells, like I just saw Yahtzee did a review of Chasm the other day. And you know, he's always kind of...
acerbic.
Yeah. He's, well, you know. Whatever. I won't say anything about his review style, but he basically found a point that a lot of people found was she has a spell upgrading thing, right? So if you get the daggers and you find her book of incantations, she can use gems and take the power from them and make your spells more powerful. So all the spells in the game can be upgraded twice. So with the daggers, you go from normal daggers to double daggers to eventually like Black Tiger style triple daggers. So you're throwing three at a time.
Nice.
Well, so that actually ended up being a late addition to the game. And a lot of the stuff, like, you know, we just didn't catch some of the problems. Like I designed, like, a mini-boss. So, you know, you couldn't get, like, a good vantage point on it. Like, say you stood in the doorway and, like, you're a little bit above him. Like, you couldn't use the knives and sit there and throw them at him because they'd go over his head, right? But when we added the spell upgrades... You know, I didn't recheck all these like tiny situations. So all of a sudden it was like you got these three daggers that spread and now people were able to sit in the doorway and just kind of like cheese them. And that also kind of extended with the balancing as well. Like there were some enemies, especially a couple of the bosses that didn't have blocking moves at all. And like you could like spam these things like really bad on them. So, of course, that was like one of the things he brought up was once you get the triple daggers, the game's over because you could just like walk through everything. And, you know, man, it's tough. Like, I guess, like, for me, it's like, I don't, if I got like a game breaking item, like if I was playing through not just Chasm, just any game, if I got some game breaking item, like maybe as a rare drop or, you know, maybe just because they missed something in the game, I'm not the kind of person that would use it. Like, I like the challenge of games. Like, that's why I play them. Like, I like all the old school stuff, you know, shmups and that kind of quick reaction time and stuff. So personally, I wouldn't use it. But I guess that's pretty much what happened was, you know, like, I didn't catch a lot of these situations after we added that because I don't play like that, you know. And by the time we got feedback, it was like too late. You know, the game was already out. So, you know, I did another balancing pass. We've like made all these like metrics. You know, we made this like our programmer made this special hitbox and you could just throw things at it and it'll tell you like at this level, your knives are doing, you're using this much mana and it's doing this much damage over this period, you know, and then we could actually see like all the spells and see all the damage values and see what they're doing. And we completely rebalanced it for 1.03 that we just released. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just like you see like reviews, like Yahtzee's review. He's just like, I got the triple daggers. I walked through everything. And the whole end of the game was boring because of that. And it sucks because it's like that was his one chance to experience the game probably. And we kind of failed him. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we created this situation where you could cheese out the game. And people do. Like, and I think it's like human nature to a point. You know, like you want to find ways to exploit things. And it's like, even though you might not be having the most fun you could, like sometimes it's just hard not to, you know, it's just like,
well, you know, for some people, cheesing a game is fun. Like,
yeah,
they get frustrated when they come up against too many.
Oh, yeah.
Too much friction.
Well, some people just love cheat codes. We've had people asking us, like, just tell me the cheat to get all the items. That's all I want. I just want to, I don't care about getting achievements. I don't care about anything else. I just want all the stuff and run around and kill stuff. And it's just like, well, you know, if that's like how you like playing, here's the cheat code for the PC version, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, how do you tell someone they're playing wrong? Like, if they're having fun, then that's great, I guess. As long
yeah.
as they're not ruining it for anyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fine. Procedural generation is really interesting to me because it seems like something that is, you know, inherently contradictory to the idea of an exploration, an exploration-based game where you have, you know, gates, where you have like a progression of things you have to find. And I know there are people who have programmed like Zelda and Metroid game ROM
the randomizers,
yeah, where it changes up the order in which things appear, and that's fine, but
it's almost game breaking in a way usually.
Yeah, like I think it's there's novelty to that, but I don't think that can be the base game. So
well,
so the idea of putting those two together seems really challenging. And I look at something like Rogue Legacy and I don't really think it's that fun. I think, you know, Flint Hook did okay, but it's much more of, you know, sort of these like self-contained spaces
yeah.
where you're not really doing exploration so much as just kind of moving around through these
complete
small
each,
dungeons. Yeah,
yeah,
it's like you've got 20 screens total,
gotcha.
And then you move on to the next one.
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, it's not totally contradictory. Like, I mean, I think, like, the exploration and procedural really go hand in hand because if you replay the game, you're probably going to have to still check your map to see, like, where am I going? You know, like, because, like I said earlier, like, the general flow of it is usually the same. Like, you might know you need to go left, but then you walk into a room and you're like, do I go up or down? Like, at least we could still have people pulling up their map and being like, hey, I don't have this entire game memorized in my head. Like, so I think it does work. Procedural works great for exploration in that aspect, but like you said, it's when you get into the gates and these, like, kind of key points or tent poles, I call them, like, that kind of hold the game up, that's where I didn't think it could be procedural. I don't know, maybe there was some way to do it, but like to me it felt like to design, and you know, like I always like keep reiterating over and over with this game is like I wanted a classic feel to it, even though it's got procedural generation and you know some gimmicks like that, like I still wanted that classic feel to it where you see, just like we were talking earlier, oh, I'm probably going to need the double jump to get past here, you know? I mean, maybe we could have randomized that, so that would be a slide point instead. But that kind of gets into the second part, where I kind of felt like the power-ups in a lot of these games were underutilized, except for gates. Like, a lot of them almost just treat them like keys. You know, it's like Symphony of the Night has one, the Jewel of Open. You know, it's a power-up, but it's really just a key, right? Like, it's, like, literally a key. Like, it used to open, what, one or two doors, I think. So I wanted to make sure that, like, every power-up you got felt substantial, and I tried to use them as much as possible in the areas. So it's, like, when you get the ledge grab, like, a lot of the catacombs is designed around using the ledge grab. Because if you compare the maps in the mines to the catacombs, like, the mines, if you're doing any sort of, like, vertical climbing, it's all one-way wooden platforms that you can jump through, and you just kind of like climb up, whereas the catacombs is pretty much all ledge grab points. You're like trying to jump from point to point and climbing like that way. So I really wanted like a lot of those like tied in as much as we could into the area design. And that's another thing, because I figured like if I did go the way where they could be interchangeable, then all the areas are just going to feel the same, because I'd have to design them the same where you could use any power up to get around them. So I kind of doubled down on that, and I was like, okay, you know, the catacombs is the one that you're going to need the ledge grab heavy for, and then the keep, like, you really need the wall jump to get around. There's just, like, almost no ledge grab points at that point. It's just, like, lots of tight spaces where you could wall jump up or different things like that. And then later on in the game, we introduced the flip, where that also kind of ties in with the wall jumping, so you can kind of climb a single wall, almost like the old Mega Man games, Mega Man X and all that. So yeah, I tried to tie those in to make it feel less generic, but you know, it's always this balancing point of like how far do you go random and how far do you go with kind of design stuff, like purposeful stuff and designing things around it. Because the further you go down that like route of designing things around the power-ups and around this, like the further you kind of like lock yourself into a more handmade experience, you know? So,
and that's what I've always felt is sort of the defining feature that sets Metroid apart from other exploration-based games, in that you don't have keys. You have power-ups for Samus.
Yeah.
And they are combat maneuvers that also allow you to navigate the world and find new places. And I don't think other games typically are very scrupulous about that. They're like, well, here's some keys. I mean, even Symphony of the Night, as you said.
Yeah.
Whereas Metroid, you know, you get missiles, now you can break open doors. You get power bombs, now you can break open other doors. You get the, you know, the space jump, so now you can avoid enemies more easily in the screw attack, but you can also reach new areas.
It's almost like dual purpose in a way, because they are keys, but then, like you're saying, they actually have a useful function outside of that that you need.
Like, right. Yeah. I mean, it feels like you are making Samus more powerful, and in the process, oh, hey, I just opened up more of the world. Yeah. And it feels very organic in a way that you rarely see in exploration based platformer action games.
Yeah, I agree. I really like Shadow Complex too when it came out. Like, I really felt like that game got a lot of like what Metroid was doing.
Yeah, I was too harsh on that game when it first came out.
Yeah, I can
see. Going back, I'm like, you know, I think I deemed this for being too derivative of Super Metroid in terms of structure, but you know, looking back, I think this is one of the few games where the developer really got what makes Metroid work.
No, I totally agree. Like, and I think they had a few fun additions to it, especially like the foam gun always comes back to my mind, like as something that was just like so fun to play with. And I think that's something we got hammered a little bit on with Chasm, is like we didn't really bring any crazy new mechanics to it. And a lot of that goes back to the Castlevania stuff, you know, and our hero in the game, we call him Dalton, but, you know, we kind of decided in the final game not to really give him a name, but we just wanted him to be an ordinary guy, you know, in a fantasy world, and kind of focus more on the melee combat. I mean, there's some spells you can get. They're all influenced by Castlevania and Ghouls and Ghosts, pretty much, like all the different ones you can buy. Like we were saying earlier, like this game to me was supposed to be kind of picking up the torch for those games that left off, and it's like I didn't want to get too crazy with it in any aspect. Like I didn't want it to be some game where it's like it's a Metroidvania, but you're in a weird spaceship flying around. You know, like that's not what I wanted. Like I wanted this like ground down to the ground reality kind of tight combat Castlevania style game. And you know, it's like every time you start thinking of mechanics to add to it, it's like what can we add? I ended up leaning more almost towards the Metroid side, like you were saying. Like all the abilities you get in it are very acrobatic related. Yeah. Like the gloves and the wall jumping and the, you know, that kind of stuff. Like it all kind of adds on to your moveset versus giving you crazy weird stuff. And that was definitely deliberate. I don't know if that was to the harm of the game in the long run, because there's nothing in it that like really stands out from other games. Like, I mean, like tons of games have double jump, and tons of games have wall jumping and, you know, these things that you unlock through the game. So I don't know. Maybe that was to our downfall in a way. But I also felt like if we got too weird with it, it wouldn't feel like the games I wanted it to feel like.
Right. Well, you know, I just kind of playing through a few different seeds and kind of looking at the way the game unfolds, I noticed that there are a lot of subtle things that I think work in favor of the game. It maybe doesn't have crazy, amazing, like, wow, I've never seen this in a video game before.
But yeah.
there's a lot that you do that I've noticed in games. Like last year, I got, you know, kind of carried away mapping out Metroid and some other games. And one thing I noticed in, you know, drawing out the maps for Metroid and looking at the way everything works out is that each area of the game, besides having its own color palette, you know, and background graphics, it has its own feel to it, its own structural feel.
Yeah.
Like if you look, you know, Brinstar, the starting zone, it's all like long corridors and tall shafts.
Yep.
But then you get down into like Ridley's lair and it's very dense.
Yeah.
It's all the, and Norfair also, like it's all these like super interlocked, you know, crisscrossing pathways that you have to, just like clusters on the map as opposed to Brinstar, which is all spread out. And I noticed that you do some of that with, like the mines are kind of like Brinstar where it's all pretty much spread out, but yeah. Then you get into the keep and it's just like this dense knot of passageways that are all clustered together on the map.
Yep.
And you know, having that sort of difference between dense exploration and more like traversal spaces, I think that really helps keep some variety. And I don't think it's necessarily something people notice, especially because you don't have the whole map displayed at once. You have to kind of
toggle between different maps.
So you might not, you know, someone who's not, you know, trained or hasn't taught themselves to map in a video game might not really stop to think like, oh, like the mines look really different than the keep.
Well, and I think a lot of that too, it's kind of pacing and also like, you know, in particular in the beginning of the game, it's like you're like teaching people without letting them know. You know what I mean? And it's like you want to keep the pace up and you want to give them something straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, this part of the game, we're just running down hallways, killing enemies. Like there's not really, you know, okay, you might see some spots where you'll be able to come back later, but there's not really any major branches where it can confuse you, where it's like, oh, this way goes out, you know, so many rooms down this, and then maybe you'll find out you can't proceed, and then this other way is really the main path. Like I tried to keep it straightforward all the way up until the second area. And that's where, once you get to that catacombs lock, that's like the first spot in the game where it's like, all right, you're on your own from here, dude. Like, you're just going to have to explore and figure out what's next. But I at least wanted like that first hour of the game to get you into the controls, get you into some minor exploration, getting used to like we were talking earlier, poking your head in each room, see what's in there, you know, see if it's worth even going that way or if you should just continue on the way you are. And I mean, like these are all things that, you know, you have to take into consideration, I guess, when you're doing this stuff. But in general, I tried to keep the beginning of the game more straightforward and just kind of straight shot passages. And then towards the end, it definitely becomes a little bit more like once you get to the temple area, that's very much inspired by the last dungeon in the first Zelda. You know, when you're in Ganon's dungeon and it's just like warps all over the place and you're like, where the hell am I? Like, I very much went for that same feel for the penultimate area in the game. Because I wanted that kind of feel where it just throws you off from the rest of it. You're just like, ooh, you're like all turned around and like just wondering where to go next, you know. So I wanted that escalation feeling to the game, and I think some people get it, and some got frustrated once they got there. They're like, what the hell? I've been running around this place. I can't figure out where to go. Because it's once you get to that point, I know you haven't seen it yet, but I would call it more islands. Because, you know, like when you're in the mines or like the catacombs, it's all like one big interconnected structure. Mm. You know, like all the rooms are connected together. The game originally wasn't designed like that, though. Our earlier attempts at the procedural generation, it was hard for us to combine those sections together without the rooms overlapping. So it's like if you had one section that went off kind of upwards to the left and one that went off downwards to the left, sometimes like they'd kind of build up into each other and there would be problems. You know, you'd get rooms overlapping and things like that. So in the beginning, we had all the dungeons kind of separated out into about 10 to 15 room. We called them sub areas. So there was like five main sub areas to the mines. Like you'd go through about 10 rooms. And then it would you'd eventually get to a door, and it would just have like a dotted line on your map that would connect to another door. So they didn't physically connect. It was just kind of like a spatial connection. Like, okay, if you walk through this door, you'll traverse this dotted line. Kind of like in Super Metroid, you know, where you see the elevators. It's like they don't really connect since you're going between areas, but, you know, you can see on your map like, oh, okay, this connects to that. So it was more designed like that. So you'd like go through 10 rooms or so. Then you'd get to like one of these doors with a dotted line that would teleport you to another, and then you'd go through that. So everything kind of felt a bit more disconnected. And that was one of the things that Dan Adelman pushed for us last summer. So that was actually a more recent change where we were like, okay, let's try to get everything connected into like these kind of mega structures. And we went back at it again, and we figured it out that time. But so for the temple, I left it kind of like the old school way was. So the all the main areas are all like these big masses now, but then when you get to the temple, it's all these like little areas, and they all have these teleporters. It has its own teleportation system that's different than the rest of the game, and you're just kind of like going in between like all these like different little chunks, and you're like, where the hell am I? Which teleporter and which one was the one that takes me where I need to go next?
Yeah, but that disorienting disorienting feel can work to the game's favor when it's a change of pace. Like it makes me think of The Hanging Gardens in Aria of Sorrow, Castlevania Aria of Sorrow, where everything is, you know, contiguous up until that point of the game, and then all of a sudden you're like going to these sort of standalone spaces that on the map are all disconnected, and you don't know exactly where you're going.
Yeah, and you don't. What's happening here?
Yeah, it becomes kind of confusing, and you have to you have to rethink how you are traversing the game map. So yeah, I think that that's, you know, kind of using that legacy style in an interesting way is a smart idea. Thing I think really works to the game's favor is that I kind of feel like the game maybe isn't designed around the placement of save rooms, but there's clearly a lot of thought put into how far the save rooms are apart.
Yeah.
And because you don't regenerate health unless, you know, you get the mithril armor, I guess, you know, you don't pick up health drops from enemies like you do in Metroid. It's more like Symphony of the Night.
Yep.
It becomes almost like those are your little havens of exploration, and you know, every time you venture out, you're kind of taking this risk reward element. Like, I'm up against really hard enemies, and I think there's something further out here, but maybe I want to go back to the last save point because I found a really cool drop, and I don't want to run out of health before I get to the next save point and lose that cool drop, and I have to, you know, start over without it. So it does create this real sense of, you know, pushing into danger and leaving your safe zone. And then, you know, there are special events like the Wheel of Fortune or whatever, where you're really like, okay, I'm putting it all on the line here. Is this a good idea or not? When was the last time I saved? Have I found anything since
then?
How far
am I from the save point?
Yeah, so it does become this kind of game of calculations.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it helps to have sort of an exploratory mindset. We were talking earlier before the podcast about the way I approach a game like this is anytime I come across a door, I at least look through to see what's on the other side. and then decide, eh, maybe I don't want to go that way. So then I head up to a different, you know, to a different door or something. But I want to at least know, like, is there a save point here? Is there a treasure here? What's happening? Like, I need to know. Like, I got to get a case for my surroundings. And having the procedural generation, I think, is a pretty interesting way to keep people on their toes, even once they do, you know, complete the game. Because then when they return, they're like, well, I know how this works in general, but I still don't know where the next save point is.
Yeah, and I think if you play... Yeah, well, and this is getting back into, like, see, I think you got to be a big fan of these games if you want to play them multiple times, but we added the mortal mode.
Who isn't?
Who isn't? Oh, I could tell you a lot of people on Steam that aren't. No.
Just go check the Steam reviews.
Yeah, exactly. What I was going to say, though, is we added the mortal mode, which kind of harkens back to the original roguelike idea of permadeath. And, dude, it gets pretty crazy. Like, if you play on the hard mode with permadeath and you don't know where you're going sometimes... Like, you don't know exactly how long some of these paths are going to be or what enemies exactly are going to be in the next room. It becomes pretty tricky, like, with your decision-making process of, like, do I double back and hit that save point or do I keep trying to push forward? Because, you know, it's like that idea of, like, if you don't know what's ahead, you're actually faced with some tough choices, you know? Like, and I think that's definitely one of those things that makes games in particular interesting is that element of choice in them. Mm-hmm. You know, some people will hang around a save point and just farm the hell out of everything, get as many item drops as they can, overlevel their character, and then just like walk through the next boss. Some people will just play see their pants and not even check some of the rooms like you were saying. They'll just run straight forward and do whatever. Like, there's so many different play styles. But I think that's what's great about this kind of game is like you can do that. Like, you can kind of decide how you want to play it and kind of control the level of challenge to yourself if you want. Because if you compare to something, you know, more straightforward, say like Metal Slug or Contra or something, like, you know, you're on a path and you pretty much have to go through these enemies. There's no choice there, you know. I mean, there is some, like, you know, depending on the platforming and stuff, but overall, you really don't have a lot of choice in those kind of games, like how you want to proceed. So... I don't know. But yeah, regarding the save points, like, I did deliberately try to keep them all about 15 minutes of gameplay, 20 tops from each other. As you start getting towards the end of the game, that also changes up a little bit. We try to tie the lore into as much as possible, too. Like, even the save points themselves are tied into the lore. And there's a little bit of frustration with some people because the temple area I mentioned, there is no save points because it wouldn't make sense lore-wise for them to be in there. So, you know, I mean, there's a way to get out, though, and save, but it's a little bit less inconvenient, you know. And I thought it would be interesting, though, once again, to try things that mix it up like that. Like, oh, you're used to being able to just go to a save point easily and farm around it. No, not now. Like, now you got to teleport out of this area completely if you want to save, you know, those kind of things. So I don't know. Like, I tried to keep the game as varied as I could, going from area to area and make sure each one, like you said, had a different feel to it, not only with just kind of how the overall structure is, but just the general idea of the enemies and the hazards and, you know, how you solve the area, I guess you'd say. Like we were talking earlier, like the mines is very straightforward. Like there's no overarching puzzle to that area or anything to get through it. It's just like literally run down corridors till you get to the boss at the end. Then you get to the catacombs and it gets a little bit more mixed up because you get to that lock gate and all of a sudden it's like you're not just walking straight forward anymore. And then you get to the next area and it's also got something like that where you come to this pool of water and you can't get to the other side of it without raising the water level. So then you're exploring around that area trying to figure out how to do that. And then the next area has another hook like that. So I tried to bring like an interesting hook to each area like that and then also kind of mix it up. But like I said earlier, like I think I failed a little bit in the catacombs kind of easing into that when I had all those puzzle clues kind of separated out. Like, I think that was kind of a little bit too much too soon. So hopefully that tweak helped that. But I definitely wanted it to kind of feel like as you were going, things got a little less, not just like convenient, but I don't know, just make you think a little bit more, you know, a little less obvious, I guess.
Right. thing that I think is really different from games like Castlevania is that the enemies have very specific behavior patterns. I mean, you know, Castlevania, you have Medusas or whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like the enemies in this game are very much about, like, they'll hit you really hard unless you know how to avoid them. You have, you know, wizards who kind of shoot this arcing beam at you. You have, you know, like armored kobolds who take a big old swipe at you. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the game really does revolve around kind of backdashing or jumping over attacks and managing kind of space and
like
preventing
learning.
Enemies from ganging up on you and getting, you know, getting caught in the crossfire between a lot of patterns. Where is that, like, where's the inspiration for that?
Well, honestly, like, a lot of that comes from me just thinking Symphony's too easy.
Okay.
that was a lot of it was like, I mean, that game's, like you were saying, it's like you almost really need to play in luck mode to, like, give yourself a true challenge in that game. Just because it feels so straightforward. Well, once you get to the upside down castle, I think it gets a lot more challenging, but also gets a lot weirder at the same time. It's like you got those Zelda style spike traps on the floor everywhere.
That's exactly what I was thinking with the skeletons and like the bouncing kettle.
Oh god, I hate those things.
Down the hardware.
Yeah. Some of those enemies were just annoying to me, so I tried to keep as much as I could the enemies not annoying, but have. It was a very much like a building process, like when I made the enemies, because it's like almost all the behaviors are similar. Like there's only so much you can do in 2D, right? Like it's like you're standing to the left or right of the enemy. It has an attack you need to avoid, and then you got to move in for the kill, right? With these kind of games, at least, like you're kind of penalized from using range attacks from the hearts that you have to collect or the mana in Chasm. So it's very much a game of close combat. So there's only so many situations you could possibly create, you know, where it's like you got to go in and out. But, you know, as the game goes on, a lot of the enemies get bigger, their strikes get bigger, like their range. But like, as you said, like I also tried to mix it up with like the necromancer's got like the laser beam that can shoot. There's a lot of enemies late in the game that have like trickier projectile attacks. So it's like you got to get in quick and then get away because they're going to shoot some crazy projectiles at you that are going to be hard to avoid, things like that. But I really wanted it. A feel of building throughout the game. So there's a couple base enemy behaviors, I would call it, that we kind of build off of. You got like the floaty guys that just float at you, you know, and then as the game goes on, they kind of change behavior a little bit. And then you've got what I would call the kind of core melee enemies. So those start out as like the kobolds in the mines. They're very much just like kind of stand there. If you approach them, they'll either strafe towards you to attack or strafe away from you to avoid your swings. Once you go into the catacombs, those become the whites, the kind of undead dudes with the white cloaks. And then you go into the gardens and they're like these like purple sludge guys that have crazy claws and like jump at you. So it's kind of all the same base behavior on those, but like it's all tweaked for each area. So it's like how far can they reach? How fast can they move? Those kind of things. And then we've got like the bigger heavy hitting dudes, you know, especially in the gardens, we've got the rock golems. They're like double the size of the player. And if you get too close, they'll like stomp the ground in front of you and hit you with a shockwave. Or if you get too far away, they'll like throw rocks at you, like these huge boulders, you know? So, in those kind of cases, it's like you want to make sure if the player runs away too far, you can still hit them, you know, but if they come too close, you also want an attack that works for that too. So as you get farther into the game, a lot of the enemies start getting double attacks or at least two. Sometimes even three, depending on them. So yeah, it was just like a game of like building, kind of introducing concepts to the player, and then just like continually taking it a step further, until you get to the end of the game, and like those simple guys that we were talking about now can like do flip attacks at you and combos, like three hit combos and like different things like that, where it's like you really got to be on your toes and like understand their attack patterns, or you'll just get destroyed. You know?
Yeah, I think the game is pretty good at sort of. Giving you a sense of mastery of overcoming steep obstacles and tough odds, because I come into a new area every time and I'm like, oh God, it's destroying me. But you know, after you play for a while, you get new equipment and you level up a little bit, and then you go back to revisit once you get a power and you're like, oh, why were these guys ever hard?
Well, and I think
at the moment, like my main go-to weapon is the leather whip, and I know at some point that's not going to be powerful enough.
Yeah,
and I keep like getting anytime I find an item that makes me a little stronger that I can equip, I'm like, I'm going to put defense in the background and focus on strength so I can keep this whip as long as possible because it has like the best feel to it of all the weapons. But I know that's not going to last forever, and it's going to be a long time before I can make that platinum whip. So like platinum chain in between there, I don't know what is waiting for me. So I've really got to, yeah, like I'm kind of dreading the point at which my go-to weapon becomes obsolete.
But yeah, that happens, you know, though.
That's the tension.
Well, and I think that's part of the thing. Like, so it's like when you walk into that new area, you've got new enemy patterns to learn. And that's really the core of it. I mean, like, yeah, you can focus on, and I mean, like, I kind of missed this for a long time too, and I kind of had to figure it out, but the core of this game really is the enemy encounters. Like, I think it's easy to get, and this is going right back to the main concept of the game, it's easy to get lost with a Metroidvania style game and focus on the backtracking and the power-ups. I mean, yeah, that's like what the genre is known for, but at the same time, that's not what really makes a Castlevania game a Castlevania game. It's the room-to-room combat and, you know, encountering these new enemies, learning their patterns, and then overcoming them.
Yeah, and I think even some of the Castlevania games have lost sight of that. Some of the ones on DS, you're kind of like, yeah, it's another big room, like just a big box with some enemies in it, and yeah. I don't care.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's very tricky. And, you know, one of the things that we kind of got beat up for in some of the reviews was people saying the rooms were boring. You know, it's like, there was like three rooms in a row that just had enemies to fight. And I mean, it's tricky. Like, I want the game to feel varied. Like, we have, you know, with the way the procedural generation works, I made rooms that are just platforming rooms. Mm-hmm. And you probably saw some in the mines and some in the catacombs. Like, in the mines, you've got like these like little wooden platforms. They're kind of over these pits of like poison fog. And then when you get into the catacombs, it's a little bit more Super Metroid. It's like these pits of ooze, and then you've got like these kind of towers sticking out of them that you're kind of ledge grabbing from one to the next on. So I tried to put in stuff like that to mix it up instead of just like constantly running down hallways fighting stuff. But that really is the core of these games, is running down hallways fighting stuff. And I mean, the reality is like I could make rooms that are like big square things where you're like going up and down and whatever, but like one that doesn't work great with the procedural generation, because how many of those rooms can you put back to back till you get tired of that? You know, like this constant like up and down kind of thing and going back and forth. Two, I don't know. Like it just didn't. I tried that a lot, but it just kept coming back to like you need straightforward combat. Like that's what made the game feel good. And like earlier on in the early builds of the game. Around 2015, we put out for our Kickstarter backers a beta build. Or, well, we called it an alpha then, even. And we kind of got tore up by them because my initial gut reaction when I started designing the game was I want 50% platforming, 50% combat. I felt like that would be like a good mix, right? So you wouldn't get bored of it. You know, you'd go down one hallway, fight three enemies, then you go down another hallway and you'd have some platforming, and then you'd go down another, you'd be back to fighting enemies. But when we put that into practice, people were like, man, this is just punishing and it doesn't feel good to explore at all. Like, I feel like if I backtrack ever, it's just annoying because it's like you've just constantly got all these obstacles to jump over and you're not fighting enemies, so you're not gaining experience, you're not getting chances at drops. So it really became more of like an 80-20 thing. Like, the more we pushed it, like, it's like, okay, we need more combat then, because the platforming makes it annoying to backtrack and you can't get, you're not fighting these enemies and like feeling more powerful. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just like this whole, I don't know, man. It's like you're constantly balancing this thing and like on a thumbtack, it feels like. It feels like at any moment the whole thing could just fall over, you know? It's like if you don't get it quite right. So we've messed with that a lot, like just trying to get it to a point where it felt like the gameplay was varied, but it wasn't annoying to backtrack. And it felt like you still had chances to get item drops, and it felt like you were making progress and not just going in this like twisted, like up and down and left and right, like to kind of keep things feel like they're moving forward. So that's kind of why it ended up how it did, with like more straightforward corridors kind of like leading to bigger hubs that then kind of branch out in different directions. Like, that's why the design ended up a little bit closer to that, was to prevent these other problems. But then people are like, well, all the rooms are just straight shots and the background art isn't that varied, and you know, this or that. It's just like, well, It's just a lot of work, I guess. And I think, like, you know, what we're up against with Castlevania in particular, like, I think their plus side was that they had a pretty big art team, mm-hmm. and they would just throw people and be like, look, make all kinds of crazy assets. And if you look at Symphony of the Night, the art quality is all over the place, especially once you start getting to, like, some of those smaller areas that are, like, a little harder to get to. Like, they're a little less... They're a little more off the beaten path.
Yeah, like the underground caverns with the ice and everything. That's all pretty repetitive. But then you have something like Olrox's lair, where it's like every room is different.
Every room feels different.
There's like, you know, this huge courtyard with a blood fountain, and there's a prison, and there's a banquet hall.
Yeah, every single one.
It's really all over the place. And even within the castle, like every area, the moon looks different.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it's a full moon, sometimes it's like a crescent, sometimes it's behind clouds.
There's some crazy variation in there. But so, I mean, like in hindsight, I really wish we would have had double the art almost just to like make sure all of these rooms feel different in a way. I kind of feel though, like either way, you'd probably get back into the enemies again. Like one of the things I like about Castlevania is like some of the rooms feel pretty themed. Like you were saying, like, you go down to the ice area, there's like certain enemies you see in those rooms. But like, I don't know. Like if you're in a castle and you're in like room after room, it's like, well, you can't just make the dining room, especially if it's a procedural game, you'd only see the dining room once, you know? It's like you kind of want to make things that you can use multiple times. And even with this, I was kind of like, well, you know, it's not so bad if you see the same room twice, if it has different enemies in it and there's something different about it. Like, because, I mean, the room's just a room. Like, the room is the placeholder for the combat, like I was saying earlier. Like, that's the core of the game. Like, it's kind of the set, just set that up for you. And it's like, it really doesn't need to be different. But I think that's one of the things that they did do right with a lot of these Castlevania games is that they usually have at least, like, one piece of unique art in a room. It might just be a fountain or something in the middle. One of the rooms I really love in Symphony is that one that's, like, the longest hallway ever made.
Yeah, the marble corridor.
You know exactly what you're talking about.
The eyeball floating in the
background. And you're just like running down this thing. And you know the funny thing? I think this might be something I look into coming up. The thing I noticed about Castlevania, and I think this might be one of the things that people are kind of complaining about, but they don't realize it, is in that game, they usually group all the enemies together. So like even in that room, I think it's pretty much the same enemy.
Yeah, it's like the Diplosyphilis, the like plant monster with the girl.
It's got the crazy tail coming off.
And then there's the Stone Rose.
Yeah, like right in the middle or something like that.
Like Fleeman, I think maybe, but it's pretty much just three enemies.
Yeah, it's like repeated. And I think that was almost to our detriment that our procedural generator mixes things up so much, because if you walk into a room, say in the gardens, and it's got like a blue toad in it, and a rock golem, and one of those fungus guys, I basically put spawn points in them and then said, like, hey, these things work well here, right? So it's like you walk into the room. It could be any of those. Like, I mean, it's decided when you start a new game. But then it's like you go to the next room, and because it can be any of those things, I think it almost unintentionally feels less varied because it's more varied, right? So if you walk into a room that has those three different enemies, and then you walk into the next room and it ends up with a similar set of enemies as well, it almost kind of feels the same. Even though it's got a lot of variation inside the room, I feel like maybe if you're going to that next room then, maybe it would have been better to say, hey, this is the room with the mushroom guys, and it's got four of them. And then you go into the next one, and it's got the ones with the fungus guys or with the rock golems, you know, like three in a row or something like that. So I don't know. Maybe in our case, like that was a little bit of a detriment. And I feel like maybe the art on the same token also kind of fell into that where, it's like our artists made five different things for the backdrops that can be used. Like, you know, in the catacombs, we've got these skeletons that go in the walls or like banners that hang. And it's like when you're styling a room, you want the room to feel as varied as possible. So I'm using the skeletons, I'm using the banners, and then I've got like these enemy spawns that are like random. But then it's like when you got two rooms back to back and they both share these common elements of like banners and skeletons, I think it ends up feeling almost too similar. So it's like we were a little bit too focused on making the room itself inside feel too varied, you know? So maybe it should have just been one room has banners and skeletons. The next one, or some mummies or whatever that you fight, and then skeletons in the background wall. And then the next room should just be skeletons in the backgrounds and then just certain enemies you fight. mean, we're still tweaking things, obviously. So these are changes I can make. But this is just so the kind of...
That's what I want to talk about is the fact that this is still kind of a living product. You know, you are still tweaking. And because it is not a game where everything is set in stone, I feel like that leaves you a lot of latitude to go back and say, you know, we can make changes. We can, you know, depending on how much energy and time and money you want to put into this, you can address a lot of these things because it's not like you're going to be taking away this place that people know and have become invested in. Because
it's not like the 90s either, where it's like once it's burned to a ROM on a cartridge, that's the game.
You've got the ability to push updates. I assume this is coming to other platforms at some point. I don't know if you have like a Sony exclusivity deal or if you can go to Xbox One. Does anyone go to Xbox One these days? I don't know.
There's dozens of us. Dozens!
But, you know, you do have, I feel like, the freedom to change up the game on a fundamental level to say, you know, let's tweak this. But is that something you want to do? Do you feel like that's a betrayal of people who have invested time into
I got the perfect analogy for you, and this just happened like yesterday.
Okay.
So I know you haven't gotten there yet in your playthrough, but there is a parachute item that you get, and it is basically lets you kind of float across long gaps. Well, the way I designed it was you press jump once, you jump up in the air, you press jump again and hold it, you deploy your parachute and you fall. But this ended up causing a lot of trouble, especially when you get the flip. Once you get the flip, then it becomes more complicated because it's like you jump, and then you can flip, and then if you press it and hold it again, you can use your parachute and float. But it kind of created all these like situations where the controls won't act quite how you want them to in the time. Like, it's consistent. Like, it always behaves the same, like with the way, but sometimes, say you're like fighting an enemy and you go to jump away and you're like in your frantic and you press the jump button one too many times, you end up deploying your parachute and then all of a sudden you're like slowly going away from something that's like coming at you super quick. And it's like, shit, okay. So I ended up going back. I was like looking at it. I'm like looking at the control scheme. And I was like, you know what? I got way too much stuff on this jump button. This needs to be moved. So I'm like looking at it. And, you know, maybe I'm just dumb, but I wanted, like, very early on, people were playing the game with Super Nintendo controllers and all this stuff. So I only wanted to use one set of shoulder buttons, especially for the console or, like, the smaller handhelds and stuff. Like, I knew Vita, you really only got the L and Rs. So I didn't want to use both triggers. I wanted to keep it just to the four face buttons and then the bumpers. So I'm, like, looking at it, and I'm like, oh, my God, we got a completely open button for the air with the back dash. So in the last build I just pushed out, like, 2 or 3 days ago, I moved the parachute off the jump button to the backdash button. So now, because it's not used at all in the air. Like, it's only used on the ground. So there's no interfering at all with other controls. And I tested it for a day. I gave it to a few other people to play. Everybody came back and they were like, this is great. Like, this is a great change. I don't feel like I'm accidentally using the parachute when I'm jumping away from stuff. Or when I'm trying to do a wall jump and I press the button too early, it doesn't deploy the parachute like it was. So it felt like a great change all around. I go to push it out on Steam the other day, and then, like, almost immediately, this is unacceptable. You know, like, I'm already used to it working on the jump button. I don't want to change. Can you add an option in there to chain it on the jump button like it was? So, you know, it's like we're constantly trying to improve things, but at the same time, like, as soon as people get used to something, it is tricky to change stuff, you know?
Well, personally speaking, I think... you guys really needed a button customization feature in there because I really want to bash backdash on the shoulder button.
Yeah.
As opposed to with the triangle. Like, that's how it worked in Symphony, and it's so close. I want to do it that way again.
I know, right?
But yeah, like that.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And that is on our list to do is customizable gamepad controls. We do have it for the keyboard. We just weren't able to get the gamepad one in time. I mean, honestly, like, I didn't. For some reason, it didn't really occur to me that people would want to remap gamepads. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe I'm like, just dumb.
Why would you never want to include the ability to let people play the game?
Like, that's most do it how they want. Yeah, and I would say for the most part, that's okay. It can kind of get weird sometimes. Like, if you try to remap some buttons, like, I don't know. Like, if you the way it's set up right now, I think like the spell cycling is on the shoulders. So if you move the backdash to one of the shoulders, do you only cycle spells in one way, or does that get assigned to what would be one of the face buttons? Like, I don't know.
Like, I don't know. Like with Mega Man X, I always put dash on the right shoulder.
Yeah.
And then weapon cycling on the left. So I just cycle in one direction and
yeah.
So be it.
So actually, goes. Which Castlevania game was that? Was that Ecclesia where you could dash both directions?
That was Harmony of Dissonance.
Oh, was it?
On GBA. Maybe Ecclesia also. But
okay, yeah.
I know Harmony of Dissonance.
You could do a forward dash.
That's how I got through the castle. I just like dashed. I didn't even use the D-pad for like, I was just like dashing.
Because it was like both triggers dashed mm-hmm. both ways.
Yeah.
It was like a forward and a back. I mean, that could be pretty cool. And that would actually be something I would consider doing. You know, funny enough, speaking of the dash, like that was like one of the things like earlier on that drove me nuts whenever I'd see Symphony of the Night speedrun. Like everybody's not even speedrun. Just people just dash through the whole game backwards. It's just like, why? But I don't know. Like, I think that actually kind of bit us in the butt unintentionally because we had a delay in there before the backdash where there was like a transition animation. And it ended up slowing you down enough that you probably wouldn't want to try to speed through the game like that. But it kind of adversely affected the timing with enemies like getting away quick enough.
Mm.
So that was another one of the things in the last build I fixed was I made, and actually it really wasn't on purpose. Like when I went back and looked at it, the way that the code worked, it basically said, hey, if you press the backdash button, it plays the transition animation to start the backdash. And then once it got into the full backdash animation, then it applied the velocity. And I don't even know, like thinking back, if that was completely on purpose, but I changed it so the velocity actually starts as soon as the transition does. So as soon as you push that button now, you get immediate feedback. But once again, though, as soon as we made that change, I am accustomed to having that delay there and being able to backdash and then immediately attack while I'm backdashing. So it's like no matter what you do, there are always people out there that have already grown accustomed to what it is and have figured out their own exploits, you know, and strategies, I guess you could say, based around what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like even if they know it's for the better, they still don't like that fact that like they might have to relearn something or you kind of killed their own strategy that they've been developing. So that is something like we're being very careful of. But at the same time, I'm kind of putting these things on a scale, you know, it's like the thing with the parachute. It's like the positives way outweigh any of the negatives of somebody that's just been playing the game. I mean, the game's only been out for like, what, 2 weeks?
Right.
So it's like I'm thinking long term here, like the next 2 years, what's good for people, you know, that are going to be playing this game. So for me, that was an easy decision. I honestly didn't think in that one there would be any blowback, so I was kind of surprised when I saw people like, this is ridiculous. You can't just be changing controls. And it's just like, I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I've been one of those people before with, you know, with some things like on computers especially, I get accustomed to using things a certain way. Like Photoshop, they changed, so Command F used to be use filter, and now it brings up like a help feature. Like I don't need
constantly
this.
Pulling that
this
up by accident.
Stupid. Like now the filter, like reuse last filter, is on some like 3 or 4 button arcane combo.
Yeah.
Like so that's super frustrating. So you know I kind of get where people like that are coming from, but at the same time
it might
time,
not be for the best, but you've already learned it.
Right.
It's like
exactly.
It's like some people I guess have just settled with it and they're okay with it. You know what I mean? And then you got the others that are like, literally, like, I'm not playing this game until you fix this. And then you've got the guys that are like, yeah, it's not the greatest, but I've learned to live with it, and I'm fine with it, and don't change it. Like, you know, so you really run the whole gamut there.
The fine art of settling.
Yeah, it is really.
So what does the future hold for Chasm? It sounds like the game is not, you know, set in stone at this point.
Yeah, so
what do you talk about?
We're going to keep tweaking things. I mean, the biggest things that we've been worried about the past 2 weeks are obviously bugs are number one. We've been trying to work out all the kinks, any places people are getting stuck, whether through code or just through design, like that catacombs gate I had mentioned with the lock. So we're making some tweaks like that, making some tweaks with the gameplay, like I mentioned with the parachute. I also kind of adjusted the cooldown periods a little bit on the swords to give people a little bit more leeway, things like that. So we're making those sort of adjustments. A lot of fine tuning type things right now. Just trying to smooth out the overall experience. Nothing drastic, but you know, anything we can to improve it in the short term, that's what we're focused on at the moment. Longer term becomes a little bit more tricky. I can't really tell you anything concrete. Just because, not because it's secret, but just because we don't know, you know, it's like we're taking in all this feedback and, you know, and we were having a conversation before the podcast where it's like, we've got people coming at us from all walks of life and playing this game and giving us just wildly different feedback as far as, what they expected and what they got and what they think it should be. So, you know, I don't know. We're in that spot now where we're kind of coming to terms with, like, what is the game and what should it be and what shouldn't it be? You know, like, which we definitely do not want to change things so drastically that we turn off our core audience, which by far is Castlevania fans. Like, I think that should be number one on our priority list, is to keep those people happy and not ruin that, you know, not just give in and take out any penalties for swinging the sword whenever you feel like, and, you know, the attack canceling with the double hits, you know, with landing on the ground, that kind of stuff. Like, I think that stuff has to stay, because that's the stuff to me that is the most important in the game by far.
Yeah, I mean, at some point you have to draw a line and say, like, this is my vision for the game. And yeah, if people don't necessarily like it, you know, I have
to live with
that. It
might not just be the game for them.
Right.
You know, I feel like that's kind of another problem with today's games, like we were talking about, where it's like every game feels like it has to cater to every person, you know? And like, I just think you end up with something like unintentionally watered down, because, and I mean, like, it's the same thing with Chasm. Like, we're filing off all those rough edges, right, on the statue, but it's possible for it to end up as one of those pillow faces where you just file it down so much, like, it just loses all identity, and it loses, like, everything that, like, makes it interesting to the people that like it. So,
yeah, you know, I mean, as someone who's basically committed his life to creating a podcast that appeals to a very specific niche audience,
yeah,
there's nothing wrong with saying, like, this is who I'm working for.
Yeah, and okay. I think as a creator, is frustrating, right? Because I want everybody out there, and I'm sure you feel the same with your podcast. You want everybody out there to be able to enjoy it, but you know you can't.
Right.
Like, it's just not possible, because as soon as you walk down that line of, well, maybe this podcast shouldn't just be about video games. Maybe we should also talk about movies. You know,
well,
maybe,
do that sometimes.
Yeah. But so I think that's kind of the general idea, though, is like, the further you push it, the more it becomes unrecognizable for what you were trying to create. And I think that goes through all aspects of the game, like everything from story to UI to gameplay to the graphics. Like, it all has to follow some level of consistency to get the right feel that we wanted. And, you know, I don't know. It's really tricky. Like, I definitely want it to appeal to more people. And I think maybe it's possible by other means than just altering the main game mode. So we are looking into doing alternate game modes that will play faster and different for the people that, like, don't want so much of a slow exploration game. Because obviously we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater and just be like, nobody's getting a slow exploration game now. Like, you know, it's like, so I think there might be some ways to possibly appeal to more people without completely changing everything. So that's kind of like what we're trying to figure out right now. And it's painful, to say the least, you know, because it's like, I don't know. I feel like we've been running circles a lot, too. You know,
right.
It's like, well, we could try this, but, you know, if we can't do that right, then these people still aren't going to like it. And we could try this, but if that doesn't work quite right, then we're not going to get those people. You know, it's like, there's always some limit there. Like, I mean, just to give you an idea, like, we were talking about an arcade mode. And then you start getting into, like, well, how arcade should it be? You know, like, if it was true arcade, should there even be melee weapons? Like, maybe we could just go back to sub-weapons only and make it like Ghouls and Ghosts or something, you know, where it's like you got the daggers or the axes and, like, you're trying to figure out these ways. But you get to a point, like, where you start analyzing this stuff and you're like, yeah, but okay, we're going to throw away the things that make the game good, like the melee combat that all the enemies are based around. So then we end up changing all the enemies. And then even if we did this, the people that are into that style of game, is it going to be enough for them? You know, is this, like, if we made it a roguelike game or whatever, like a roguelike mode, is it going to have enough of those features that people identify with roguelikes to make it worth playing over and over? Or is it still just going to be like something that they're like, nah, and then the people that like the main story mode are going to be like, nah, you know, it's like you get all these ideas of things you could do, but you like really have to question, like, once you start throwing things out and changing things, like, who are you appealing to? You know, are you even going to end up appealing to the audience you're trying to in the end? Or are you just going to end up creating more problems because you create something that's kind of like what they want, but not really, you know? Like, I think, like you were talking about earlier with Rogue Legacy, people say roguelike now, and I don't even think, like, half the people think the same thing when they say that. Like, if I say roguelike to you, you might be thinking rogue. Like, yeah. ASCII graphics. Like, I start a new game, I go floor by floor, when I die, it's over. But if I say that to somebody else, they might be like, Rogue Legacy. You throw yourself at a wall and you keep playing the same thing over and over, but you're unlocking things and have this meta progression mechanic where your character is constantly getting better. But the level is just kind of always the same difficulty level, but you're just making your character better until you can kind of break through. So it's like, who is it that, like, you're even trying to appeal to if you say roguelike mode? You know, like, who, what are they expecting? Like, and I think that was, you know, getting back to those Steam reviews that are awful. it's not that bad. It's mixed right now, I think. So it's not like it's like mostly terrible or whatever the rating is. But I think there was a lot of problem in our messaging about what people should expect for the game. And we had a lot of people that came in expecting something completely different than what they got. And I mean, that's probably on us, you know, for maybe not marketing the game correctly or changing it in the past. Because, like, telling you earlier, like, when I very first started working on this game in 2012, I was posting on the TIG Source forums and saying it was a roguelike. But by 2013, I had completely dropped the roguelike word from any marketing, but somehow it just stuck with us for years and years and years. People still thought the game should be roguelike. I don't know if that's because it had procedural generation or because of how it had been marketed way earlier, and that's just how people talked about it to their friends and how it was introduced to them, and that's how they just, like, once they got that idea in their head, no matter how we changed the game, that's how it was. But we definitely had this major clash of, like, what people thought the game should be and what it was. And I feel like even if we try to go back to that and fix it, like, I don't know if we'll be able to properly, you know? It's like, so that's kind of where we're at right now with Chasm is, like, you know, if we want to appeal to more people, what can we do? And even if we try to, you know, are we going to be able to do it right? Are we going to be able to get those people back? Are they even going to like it? You know, if they play this, you know, if we made some sort of arcade mode, say, that played twice as fast as the main game and took all the exploration out and you just went room by room killing stuff and you got crazy items, there's all kind of variability. Would roguelike people even still like that? Like the ones that like Rogue Legacy because there's no meta progression mechanic? You know, like if you die and everything's gone, are they just going to be mad and be like, I'm starting all the way over now with nothing. This is crap. I should be unlocking new things each time I die. You know, like, I don't, it's just so hard now with all these different genres and different expectations and all these different game styles coming out, trying to cater to people, like, and figure out what they want, you know? And again, it's like you're almost kind of chained. Your feet are chained together because it's like, I know we can't change things too drastically, you know, because we'll lose the feel of the game. We'll lose the identity if we start trying to change the combat and change the style and all these other things. So, yeah, I don't know. I would say, like, the safe bet for now, and this is probably what we'll end up doing, is we're going to add more content. Like, we'll probably add more rooms to the game for more variation. So if you play it through, you see different things, probably more items. We've been talking about, like, small things like adding random stats on the items. So even if you get an item out of a chest, it might have plus 2% crit chance or something, like kind of like Diablo, you know. You've got, like, normal items, and then you've got, like, blue or gold label items that kind of have something special to them. So I think there's some things like that that we could add that will juice it up a little bit without kind of changing those core mechanics at all. So we could get, like, more variation, a little bit more variation in there, a little bit more this, a little bit more that. So I think that's the obvious path, but yeah, like, as far as for, you know, other people that are not super Castlevania fans, I don't know. It's kind of still a mystery to me. I think we'll try some stuff. We've got some ideas we want to prototype. We are giving the arcade mode a shot. It's not going to work how I was saying with, you know, playing with the ranged weapons. But
You know, Castlevania did that with Circle the Moon Magician Mode, where it was just like, use the sub-weapons.
Yeah, and actually that's on my list as one of the things I think we could do in the closer to the meantime, is adding some extra game modes. Because one of the things I liked about that, they actually had like kind of like luck mode. It was like mm-hmm. the thief mode. So I think that's one of the things that we're probably going to add in the shorter term, is after you beat the game, you can either play as like thief, mage, or fighter. And then it's like one of your stats is better. You know, if you're a thief, you get the luck out the wazoo, but everything else is like handicapped. I think that's something good that like gives you more variability for playthroughs, you know, to like really switch it up. So it's not so much even the world that's changing, it's more of your character that's changing. So I think those are good things we can add. You know, we'll throw some more content in there. And then I think we're going to try like a wildly different mode that plays much faster. So I think that could be a lot of fun. I mean, even as somebody like myself who is, we got an email just from like a random fan the other day, but he called himself a quote, aging gamer. And that's my new term now. I'm an aging gamer. You know,
that's what this podcast is for.
Yeah, exactly. So it's for us like 30-somes, 40-somes that are like, so it's kind of like, you know, even myself today, I find it harder and harder to pick up games. Well, you know, I feel like it's kind of like almost mirroring the kids, right? Because the kids have the low attention span and they want the immediate gratification. They just want to be able to pick up and play something and like immediately get those rewards. But I also feel like as I get older, I want to play long experiences less and less because I feel like I have less time for it than mm-hmm. I used to, you know? Like, I mean, when I was a kid, I'd play Final Fantasy VII for, you know, hundreds of hours or whatever. Now, if I pick up an RPG, like I tried to play Final Fantasy VII again last year. I mean, I still like it. I mean, it's got all kinds of problems and it's clunky and whatever else, but I still love the game. But I'm like lucky to make it an hour into it until my attention's somewhere else and I'm just put it down. And it's not like I intentionally stop playing it. It's just that there's so many things. And I mean, maybe this is the same problem with kids today, is there's so many things now competing for your attention. It's insane. And I remember back in the day when I was a kid. Here we go again. Oh, back in my day. You'd get a game, and that was it. You know? Like, I mean, you could rent one from the video store for the weekend or whatever, but if you bought a game, that was your game. You know? It's like you played that game until it was worn out.
Yeah, you don't have the captive audience anymore.
No. And it's just there's so much to pick from, and there's so much information out there, and everything's become so niche. Like, you got niches of niches now. It's just like people are going for those sales, you know, and it's just like it's hard to even compete, you know. And I mean, it took us years of going to shows and doing interviews and everything we could to get the name Chasm out there. And it's like terrifying to me to even like consider like restarting with a new game, you know, like trying to start back from scratch.
My final question here before we wrap is, this has been 6 years of your life. So at what point do you draw a line under it and say, I'm done, this is it, this is Chasm. This is the package deal, now it's time to move on to something different.
Well, I don't know, like, that's kind of my midlife crisis of the past few weeks, you know. It's kind of like, I've been all over the place. It's like roller coaster up and down and feeling like a failure and then getting an email of somebody saying, hey, this took me back to 1986 and playing with my best friend, like with Crystalis or something, like. It's like, yes, like it's like it's just it's been a total roller coaster as far as like, what is this? And like my wife and I have made so many sacrifices in order to make this game happen. She supported me for years. And I don't know. It's just depressing because it's like to the point where it's like I feel like I've given it my all and just kind of failed in a way, like where it's like it almost feels like I feel like the game itself was a success, like making a product that is like consistent and what I think is fun. But at the same time, it also feels like a commercial failure as far as just not gaining an audience. And I mean, maybe it's too early to say this.
It's 2 weeks old.
Yeah, it's 2 weeks old. But I really feel like our momentum was killed like right out of the gate with the bad Steam reviews. Let's just say the Steam reviews were bad, and then the critical reviews, like the professional reviews, were middling. You know, they were like, it's good, but, you know. And so I think that, like, kind of killed any momentum we might have had to kind of catch on with a larger audience. And now it's just kind of like, okay, we'll bring it to more platforms. Maybe Nintendo will be our crowd. Maybe Xbox will be our crowd. Maybe another game mode we could make, you know, will be our crowd. Maybe we'll find something. But yeah, I don't know. That's like the question right now is how much further do we push with this? Because like I said, in my situation, I quit my professional programming job 6 years ago now. I've been out of work. It's like terrifying for me to even think about going back to work. But at the same time, it's like the longer this goes, the harder it gets. You know, our programmer, Tim, he went back to work 2 or 3 years ago because of our budget issues. And he's just been working a day job full time and doing this in the spare time. And I know he's completely burned out with launch and just being worked from both ends, you know, so I know he's about done with it. You know, so it's just, it's tough, man. Like, you think you're going to like get to the finish line and things are going to work themselves out, but it's just like, you just find a whole new set of obstacles to go through, you know? And I don't know, maybe a month from now it'll be out on other platforms and we'll be looking back and laughing, you know, like saying like, I can't believe we were thinking about giving up, you know? Or it could be 6 months from now, I look back at this and I'm like, yeah, I should have gave up then and just like not even wasted my time and trying to get more budget and do more content and keep pushing on something that was like beating a dead horse, you know? And like, that's kind of the problem with these things, especially something creative like games, is there's no black or white. It's all gray. It's like, your game might be fun to some, it might not be to others. You might think it's cool, others might not. Like, at least when I was in software, your objectives were straightforward. It's like, we need an application that does XYZ. If you do that, it's a success. You get paid, you move on with your life. With games, it's like you're trying to find that ephemeral thing where it's like, oh, this caught my imagination and it sparked these memories and the thing was fun and I couldn't put it down. It's like, what are these things that like drive people to do that? Like, you know, like, or to think like that or to bring those emotions. Like, you're just stabbing in the dark, hoping you find something. And I feel like I was stabbing in the dark for 5-6 years. And I think we hit it on some accounts, and then on others, we probably missed, you know? So I don't know. To answer your question, like, okay, we'll just keep pushing and see where things end up.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, for my part, I feel like this game really scratches the Igavania itch that no one has bothered to scratch for a decade. So to me, I've really enjoyed my time with it, and I intend to, you know, go finish up my current playthrough as soon as I can. If for no other reason, I've got a ton of other things that I have to play. But no, I've really enjoyed it. Like, the feel of the action really captures that same momentum and responsiveness that Alucard had. Your guy doesn't have the trails behind him, but
yeah,
like in every way that really matters, you've got that. So yeah, on my, you know, on my end, I feel like it was a success. So I hope that you guys do find the audience that you're looking for. Maybe people listening to this podcast will be like, that sounds interesting. I have no idea. But at the very least, like, yeah, like you said, maybe the Nintendo audience who had a decade's worth of Igavanias and now hasn't had that for a decade.
Maybe we can bring him back.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember the olden days, the DS,
yep,
the GBA. But in any case, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. I'm sure you've got a lot of development problems to worry about. And
back
and,
to the grindstone.
Yep. So thank you for taking, you know, an hour or two out of your day to
talk about this. Thanks for keeping all this alive, you know? Like, I don't know. It's just awesome that there's people out there still talking about the games we grew up with, still loving these things, you know? And I don't know. It's just awesome. We appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, for my part, it's something that I love. And so it's always great when I come across a game that manages to capture that in a different way. And I feel Chasm does that. So I was glad to get you on the show. In any case, why don't you tell us where we can find you online and where we can find Chasm if we want to.
Yeah, sure. So number one top spot to go is chasmgame.com. That's chasmgame.com. You can check out the trailer on there, some screenshots. We're also on the Twitters and the Facebooks. The game's available now on Steam, so you can look it up on there. And then also on PSN, so PS4 and Vita. It's cross-play, cross-buy, cross-everything. So those are the main spots.
Yeah, I've been playing the Vita version, and it's really solid, except that there's a little bit of like a hiccup whenever I unlock a trophy, but that's just Vita.
Yeah, that's just Vita. Actually, the PS4 is the same, too, because it takes that screenshot when you get it.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Yeah, I don't know if Vita does that, but yeah, on PS4...
It doesn't take the screenshot, it just... It's like, whoa, networking. That's crazy.
There's things happening here.
Oh, my goodness. My old bones. Yeah. But no, great stuff. And as for Retronauts, you can find Retronauts at retronauts.com, on iTunes, at the Podcast One Network. And, of course, we're supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. That keeps the show going. Subscribe, and you get the show a week early with no advertisements and at a higher bitrate, which is cool. And myself, Jeremy Parrish, can be found various places online, but you can probably find me making my bad dad jokes at Twitter as GameSpite. But even though I'm not actually very spiteful. Anyway, so that wraps it up for this episode. Check back in a week for another episode. And in the meantime, I'm going to go play some more Chasm.
Enjoy.